So, millions of couples around the world have actually taken the marriage course. And, you know, it's widely beloved.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly popular.
Right. And it's highly practical, too. For a lot of people, it provides this much needed lifeline for just like ordinary relationship friction. But, and this is where it gets really interesting, when we ran episode 5 of this course through 4 different AI clinical reviewers, something crazy happened.
Yeah, every single one of them threw up a massive glowing red flag.
Exactly. I mean, we are talking about Grok, Gemini, ChatGPT, and Claude all independently pointing to a blind spot so severe that, well, if a facilitator or a couple doesn't handle it correctly, it could accidentally trap a partner in an abusive dynamic.
Or even trigger complex PTSD.
Which is terrifying, honestly, and it forces us to completely reevaluate how we approach this kind of material.
It really does. Because you are looking at a set of tools that are frankly phenomenally effective for their intended purpose, right?
Like helping two people navigate the blending of their backgrounds.
Yeah, right, exactly. But those same tools can be potentially disastrous if they're applied to like severe psychological structural damage. It's kind of like trying to fix a crumbling foundation with a fresh coat of paint.
Yeah, that tension right there is the core of our mission today. So, welcome to this deep dive. We are exploring episode 5 of the marriage course, which is titled The Impact of Family, Past and Present, alongside those 4 independent clinical and theological critiques.
And we really custom tailored this analysis specifically for you, the listener.
Right. Whether you are, you know, a married couple looking to strengthen your bond, or maybe you're a facilitator who actually guides couples through this exact course, the course offers some fantastic practical tools for handling in-laws and childhood baggage.
But all 4 reviewers flagged this massive danger zone hidden in the final third of the material.
Right, and it's a danger zone that could accidentally cause real harm if not facilitated correctly. So, okay, let's unpack this. Before we get to the warnings, we need to establish the core framework the episode builds on.
Which is really about how we transition from being our parents' children to being, well, a united marital front.
Right, because to understand why those red flags appeared, we first have to understand what the course is actually trying to build.
Yeah, usually when we think about starting a life with someone, we sort of imagine this blank slate. You know, you buy an empty lot, pour a fresh foundation, and you just start framing the walls.
I love that analogy, but the reality is that the lot is like never empty. You start digging to plant a garden and you hit old, rusted pipes.
Exactly. You find ancient foundations buried under the dirt.
Because you are building on top of the invisible underground infrastructure of the families you both grew up in.
It is the absolute definition of relational hidden architecture. I mean, we bring a staggering amount of unspoken wiring into a marriage.
Right. Expectations about money, conflict, affection, and loyalty. All of it. So the course anchors this entire transition in a concept drawn from Genesis 2.
Right, the idea that marriage requires a leaving of the parents.
But leaving is kind of a complex word here, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The course makes a really vital distinction that this isn't necessarily physical.
Because, I mean, a lot of people move out of their parents' house at 18. Physically, they are totally gone.
Yeah, they live in another state.
Right. But psychologically and financially, they are basically still living in their childhood bedroom.
And that is the crux of the issue. The leaving they're talking about is emotional, it's structural, it's this concept of creating a new center of gravity.
Oh, I like that. A center of gravity.
Yeah, if you think about the physics of gravity, it is the invisible force that anchors you, right? It's the central point around which your orbit is defined.
So when you are a child, your family of origin is your center of gravity.
Exactly. It regulates your nervous system, your financial stability, your decision-making. All of it orbits that family center.
But the course argues that upon marriage, that center of gravity must definitively shift. The highest loyalty and the ultimate decision-making authority has to transfer from the family of origin to the spouse.
You basically have to establish a brand new orbit.
And this isn't just like some poetic ideal. The reviewers all actually praised how the course turns this abstract concept into a highly practical, operational boundary.
Yeah, they call it the golden rule of decision making.
And the rule is incredibly straightforward, which I love. You never decide on a significant issue with your parents or extended family before discussing it and agreeing on it privately as a couple.
Never. Whether it's where to spend Thanksgiving or lending money to a sibling.
Or even deciding how to discipline your kids, the private consensus must precede the public conversation.
Because doing that systematically dismantles the potential for triangulation.
Right. And triangulation is when a third party, even if they're like a really well-meaning parent, gets involved in a two-person dynamic.
Exactly. Neurologically and emotionally, triangulation destabilizes the marital bond. It diffuses the trust and authority that should belong exclusively to the couple.
So by enforcing this golden rule, you force the marital unit to remain solid and self-regulating. It actually makes me think of forming a new corporate board of directors.
Well, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, like when you get married, your parents go from being the majority shareholders with absolute voting rights to becoming beloved, highly valued consultants.
Right. You absolutely want their advice.
Of course. You respect their decades of experience. But at the end of the day, they do not get a vote without the couple's consensus. The couple holds the voting shares now.
That structural shift is vital. You aren't cutting them off, you know. You're simply restructuring the chain of command to protect the new entity.
And the course gives this painfully relatable anecdote to illustrate what happens when that chain of command gets blurry. The presenter, Sila, talks about her mother-in-law, who is very traditional.
Oh, the clothing store, yes.
Yes. So Sila liked to dress her kids in relaxed everyday clothes, but her mother-in-law makes her daughter this bright red pinafore dress and then makes matching corduroy shorts for the boys.
Corduroy shorts, just incredibly formal.
Right. And she expects the children to wear these formal outfits to like every single family occasion.
It's a situation that I think many listeners will instantly recognize. And the tension doesn't actually stem from the fabric or the style of the clothes.
No, not at all. Sila points out that the tension spiked because the mother-in-law tried to get her son, Sayla's husband, Nikki, to take her side.
She was exerting control. It was a proxy war for authority.
Exactly. If the husband sides with the mother in that moment, or even if he just remains passive and fails to back up his wife, that tiny issue jeans versus corduroy becomes a massive wedge.
Because it communicates to the wife, my mother is still on the board of directors, and she holds veto power over your parenting.
Which is so damaging. Sticking together on the small things signals to the wider family that the center of gravity has indeed shifted.
Right. But, you know, understanding that we need a united front is one thing.
Communicating that unity is where it often completely falls apart. And that's because of the conflict styles we inherit. Which brings us back to that underground infrastructure.
Yes. The course uses a really fun animal analogy to categorize how we handle friction, the rhino and the hedgehog.
It's such an evocative shorthand for aggressive versus avoidant conflict styles. And if you are listening to this, you will probably identify your family of origin immediately.
Oh, absolutely. So the rhino comes from a family culture where everyone is loud, direct, and says exactly what they think the very second they think it.
Right. It's out in the open. It's a thrashing, and then it eventually blows over.
Whereas the hedgehog comes from an environment where you suppress your immediate reactions, usually out of fear of upsetting someone or maybe escalating a volatile situation.
Yeah, so everything is left unsaid, leading to conflict avoidance, silence, and just like internal brooding.
And usually the rhino thinks the hedgehog is being passive-aggressive, secretive, and dishonest.
Right, while the hedgehog looks at the rhino and thinks they are being chaotic, abusive, and totally out of control.
But what the independent reviewers praised here is the episode's refusal to assign moral superiority to either style.
Which is so important. Neither is correct. Both have distinct strengths and profound weaknesses.
Right. The rhino is excellent at putting the actual issue on the table, preventing resentment from festering. But their delivery can cause immense collateral damage.
Yeah, they just bowl people over. And the hedgehog is great at maintaining immediate peace, de-escalating tension, and thinking before they speak. But their silence allows the root problem to quietly metastasize.
So the goal of mapping these styles isn't to say, my family's way is normal and your family's way is dysfunctional. It's to negotiate a shared third way.
And to facilitate that negotiation, the course uses this visual exercise called the family circle diagram.
Oh, right. Where couples literally draw overlapping circles to represent their proximity to different family members growing up.
Yeah, you put yourself in the center. Close relationships overlap your circle. Estranged or non-existent relationships float separately on the page.
It's brilliant because it bypasses a lot of defensive verbal processing. You just look at the paper.
Exactly. The course mentions a husband who drew his circles, and every single family member was tightly overlapped like this dense cluster of enmeshment.
And then his wife drew hers. Yeah. And they were scattered all over the page, totally independent.
Right. And just seeing that visual contrast explained years of friction. They had entirely different baselines for what intimacy and boundaries even look like.
Making the invisible infrastructure visible is a really powerful step.
It is. But here's where it gets really interesting and where I think we have to push back a bit. Because as I was reading through the critiques, I wonder, what stops a spouse from weaponizing this insight?
What do you mean?
Like, what if someone uses this mapping as a get-out-of-jail-free card? Like, hey, I yell and say mean things because I'm a rhino. That's just my family culture. You have to accept it.
Ah, yes. That is a highly perceptive challenge, and it actually aligns directly with Gemini's clinical critique. Gemini identifies this specific risk as the fallacy of causal reductionism.
Causal reductionism. That sounds like reducing a complex choice down to a simple equation.
Precisely. It means reducing a complex moral and relational choice to a simple cause and effect algorithm based entirely on your past.
So I am X because my past was Y.
Right. But Gemini points out that understanding your background explains your psychological inclinations. But it absolutely does not revoke your moral agency to change destructive habits.
So your past explains why you have an urge to yell or to shut down, but it doesn't give you permission to actually inflict that on your spouse.
Exactly. If we look at this through Gemini's theological and clinical lens, your history forms your defaults, but it doesn't excuse unchecked aggression or stonewalling.
You can say, I have a rhino inclination and my nervous system wants to attack right now, but you still must take responsibility for regulating that impulse.
Self-awareness cannot become self-justification.
That is such a good phrase. Self-awareness is not self-justification.
Yeah.
Okay, so understanding whether you are a rhino or a hedgehog is fantastic for navigating daily friction.
Right, the small stuff.
But that framework completely falls apart when the argument isn't actually about the corduroy shorts, but about a deep, unresolved childhood wound.
Yes. That requires a totally different tool set, which brings us to the psychological core of the episode.
The course introduces a framework based on attachment theory. Now, most people who follow psychology are familiar with John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth's work on infant attachment.
Right. The idea that children need a secure base from which to explore the world, and a safe haven to return to for emotional regulation.
We've all heard that applied to toddlers. And the course uses a really nice visual of a family at the beach. The kids run out to explore, get overwhelmed, or find a cool shell, run back to the blanket to get a hug from mom.
Topping up their emotional tanks, basically.
Yeah, and then they run back out. We know how that works for kids. But the fascinating and somewhat audacious leap this course makes is trying to map that exact infant caregiver dynamic directly onto adult marital conflict.
They posit that marriage itself should replicate this dynamic, that it should serve as the primary vehicle for healing the pain of childhood, specifically for the times when our parents failed to provide that safe haven.
And to achieve that, they prescribe a very specific two-step formula for dealing with raw spots, those disproportionate emotional reactions we have when a partner accidentally triggers an old wound.
Step one is to grieve.
Right. You acknowledge and grieve the unmet needs of your childhood. And the rule for the listening partner is crucial here. Do not try to fix it.
Which requires tremendous restraint. When we see someone we love in pain, our instinct is to solve the problem, or perhaps to defend the in-laws if we happen to like them.
Yeah, but the protocol here is pure validation. Just listen. Then, step two is to forgive.
And the course defines forgiveness not as a warm, fuzzy feeling, but as an ongoing cognitive act of the will.
They share this dramatic story of a woman whose childhood was described as a nightmare. Her mother was married to an abusive stepfather, and this woman carried intense hatred for this man for 18 years.
Understandably so.
Absolutely. Finally, she decides to write him a letter of forgiveness. She sends it, and even though there was zero reconciliation, the stepfather was confused and didn't even think he needed forgiving, she experienced complete internal freedom.
The course uses this to emphasize that forgiveness is an internal release, entirely decoupled from the offender's repentance or understanding.
It sounds so clean, doesn't it? You grieve the unmet need, you forgive as a cognitive choice, and you heal. Your marriage becomes the ultimate safe haven.
And this is exactly where all four of our expert AI reviewers pulled the emergency brake.
Literally all of them. This is the massive danger zone we talked about at the top of the show. So why did Claude, ChatGPT, Gemini, and Grok all flag this specific section?
The primary criticism is what we can call the flattening of trauma.
Flattening of trauma, what does that mean?
It means the episode compresses a vast, highly complex spectrum of human pain into one single quick fix forgiveness framework.
Oh, I see. So they are treating the annoyance of the corduroy shorts using the exact same mechanical process as the severe trauma of the abusive stepfather.
Yes. Ordinary family friction and severe childhood abuse are addressed using the exact same two-step formula.
That seems incredibly risky.
It is. And it culminates in a guided visualization during the course itself, where participants are asked to close their eyes, imagine the person who hurt them, and imagine dropping the pain like sand through open fingers.
Okay, wow. If the course treats trauma like dropping sand, our clinical reviewers treat trauma like untangling a massive knotted fishing line in the dark.
That is a much more accurate clinical metaphor. Gemini points out that this visualization completely ignores the neurobiology of trauma.
Right, because complex PTSD or deep relational betrayal is not housed solely in the cognitive brain where we make logical choices.
Exactly. It is stored in the nervous system, in the amygdala, and in somatic responses. You cannot simply command a dysregulated nervous system to drop its protective adaptations in a 5-minute visualization.
Right, like just choose to let it go. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. So if a facilitator just runs this visualization with a room full of people, someone with severe trauma could be actively harmed.
They really could. They might experience a flashback right there in their chair.
Or conversely, they might feel incredible shame because they can't just drop the sand. They might think, what's wrong with me? Am I failing spiritually because my body is still terrified of this memory?
And Claude highlighted this as a profound pastoral risk. Presenting forgiveness of an abuser as a brief in-room act risks encouraging emotional bypass.
Meaning people just skip over the actual healing process?
Yes, people suppress their legitimate protective anger, mistake a one-time decision for actual psychological healing, and then feel immense guilt when their trauma responses inevitably return weeks or months later.
And ChatGPT warned about the letter writing anecdote too, suggesting that a survivor contact an abuser to offer forgiveness can be incredibly dangerous in the real world.
It really can. It can expose that survivor to renewed manipulation, retaliation, or even stalking.
Yeah, the course presents it as a victorious release, but clinically, it's a massive gamble with a victim's safety.
Which brings us to another critical vulnerability. The episode repeatedly states that marriage is the vehicle through which healing comes.
And if you're listening to this, you have to ask, isn't that an insane amount of pressure to put on a husband or wife?
It really is.
Yes, a supportive partner is wonderful, but mapping an infant caregiver dynamic onto two adults means expecting your spouse to act as your therapist.
Both ChatGPT and Claude emphasize this exact danger. A loving partner can provide a supportive environment, but they are not a licensed trauma therapist.
Right, they are not an addiction specialist. Overloading a spouse with the expectation that they must regulate your nervous system and heal your childhood trauma can easily fracture the marriage under the weight of unrealistic expectations.
It completely blurs the line between romantic partnership and clinical caregiving.
But the blind spots get even darker, right? Because everything we've discussed so far, stick together, be a safe haven, don't make decisions with your wider family, assumes a baseline of goodwill and safety in the marriage.
It assumes two healthy people trying their best.
Yeah, but what happens if the marriage itself is the source of the danger?
This is perhaps the most alarming realization from the reviewers. If you apply these rules to a coercively controlling or abusive relationship, these boundaries become weapons.
Oh, wow. How so?
An abuser can take the mandate to leave your parents and make decisions only with me and use it to systematically isolate a victim from their support network.
Because if the victim is taught that reaching out to their family for help is a betrayal of the marital center of gravity, they become completely trapped.
Exactly. The very rule meant to protect the marriage is used to imprison the victim.
The psychological isolation is profound. If the course material is presented without caveats, a victim might believe they are being a good spouse by keeping the abuse a secret from their family of origin.
That is terrifying, and it highlights why facilitators need to be so incredibly careful. But, you know, the reviewers didn't just find red flags regarding abuse and trauma.
Right. Claude pointed out a massive cultural assumption baked into this entire framework.
Yeah, the concept of leaving your parents, shifting your center of gravity entirely to the nuclear couple, is a highly Western individualistic construct.
That makes total sense, because in many collectivist cultures, healthy interdependence is the norm.
Yes, you have filial piety, joint family systems, and multi-generational households.
And in those cultures, collective decision-making isn't considered enmeshment. It's considered the foundation of a healthy society.
So if a facilitator is using this course in a different cultural context, or maybe with an immigrant couple, they have to be exceptionally careful not to pathologize a healthy, interdependent family structure just because it doesn't look like a Western nuclear family.
Right. Leaving shouldn't automatically equal geographic distance, total financial independence, or cutting off communal decision-making ties.
The framework has to be culturally adapted, or it alienates the very people it's trying to help.
And Grok brought up a fascinating point regarding neurodivergence that I hadn't even considered. The course assumes that if you overreact to something your spouse does, it's because they touched a raw spot from your unhealed childhood.
It assumes the reaction is always an emotional wound.
But Grok notes that not all intense reactions are rooted in family trauma. Consider rejection-sensitive dysphoria, which is really common in ADHD, or sensory processing overload, or generalized anxiety.
In those cases, the nervous system is overwhelmed by neurological differences, not necessarily a historical trauma trigger.
Exactly. So if a partner snaps because the kitchen is too loud and the lights are too bright, and the course tells them they need to grieve and forgive their parents for that reaction...
You are fundamentally misdiagnosing the problem.
Right. Pathologizing a neurological difference as a spiritual or family wound is deeply unfair, and it prevents the couple from seeking the actual practical tools they need, like sensory accommodations.
So we arrive at this critical juncture. We have material that offers brilliant, highly practical tools for boundaries and communication, but it is situated directly adjacent to potential landmines regarding trauma, domestic abuse, cultural norms, and neurodivergence.
So the big question is, how should a facilitator, or even just a couple sitting in their living room, actually use this course safely?
This is where we shift from the critique to the playbook. The consensus among all four reviewers is that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
The material is highly valuable, provided the right safeguards are front-loaded.
And front-loaded is the operative word here. For facilitators guiding a group, Claude and ChatGPT are explicit. You cannot wait until the end of the session to mumble a disclaimer.
You must state the safety boundaries before the video even begins playing. You explicitly tell the room that forgiveness does not mean reconciliation.
Right. It does not mean restoring trust or granting access to someone who harmed you.
Furthermore, you must state clearly that forgiveness does not cancel legal reporting, it does not erase the need for protective boundaries, and it is not a substitute for professional clinical treatment.
Facilitators also need to ensure participants know they can opt out of the guided forgiveness visualization. Give them permission to leave the room or just sit quietly without feeling like they're failing a spiritual test or holding the group back.
And provide actual specific local referrals to licensed trauma therapists or domestic abuse advocates, rather than just offering a vague suggestion to, you know, seek expert help.
Now, for the couples listening to this who want to apply the healthy aspects of the course to their own lives, the reviewers synthesized a very concrete, realistic 7-day action plan.
And I love this plan because it extracts the strongest practical value of the episode while maintaining those safety boundaries. It breaks these massive psychological concepts down into bite-sized, manageable mechanics. Let's walk you through this one-week couple experiment.
Let's do it. So day one is focused on baseline mapping. You each write down 3 strengths that you inherited from your family and 1 pattern you definitely do not want to repeat.
And the rule here is you share them with each other without debate. No arguing about whose family is worse or whose strengths are better. You are just laying out the raw data.
Right. Then day two moves to style naming. This is where you identify your animal framework. Are you a rhino or a hedgehog?
Discuss a recent low-stakes argument where that mismatch showed up. Analyze the mechanics of how you fought rather than what you fought about.
Good distinction. Day three establishes the core operational boundary. The decision rule.
This is putting the golden rule into action. Pick one upcoming decision that involves your extended family. It could be holiday travel, a financial loan, or even just a schedule change.
And you agree on what your stance as a couple is before either of you texts or calls a relative. Form the unified front first.
On day four, we pivot to what the episode calls honor action, because setting boundaries doesn't equate to isolation.
Take one safe, mutually agreed action toward your wider family. Schedule a brief phone call with a parent or send a few photos of the grandkids.
Practice the mechanic of honoring them and maintaining connection without becoming enmeshed in their decision-making or drama.
Then, day five tackles the psychological layer, grief and validation. You share one raw spot with your partner, something small that triggers a disproportionate reaction.
And the listening partner's only job is to reflect it back. You just say, I see how that hurt you. And the reason this works is rooted in neurobiology.
Yeah. When you simply validate someone without trying to fix them or debate the facts, it literally downregulates their nervous system.
It signals safety. It moves them out of the amygdala's fight or flight response and back into the prefrontal cortex. That is how validation creates a safe haven.
Exactly. Day 6 approaches the concept of release, but with necessary guardrails. We call it the sand release, but applied only to safe historical grievances.
So you sit quietly and reflect on one minor family grievance, maybe a time you felt overlooked or unfairly criticized. Choose to cognitively release it to protect your current marriage from carrying that specific resentment.
What? And this is the absolute crucial guardrail. If thinking about this grievance triggers a trauma response, flashbacks, a knot in your chest, or panic, you stop immediately.
That is the knot in the fishing line. That is your cue to seek a professional, not to push through it alone in your living room.
Finally, day 7 is the review. Look back at the week. What mechanics worked? What brought you closer?
The reviewers suggest keeping that decision rule from day 3 as a permanent, non-negotiable boundary in your marriage. And as you work through a plan like this, it is incredibly helpful to have some broader discussion questions on the table.
A vital question to ask yourselves is, where is our current center of gravity? Is it truly anchored between us? Or is one of our parents still implicitly sitting in the CEO chair of our lives?
That's a great one. Another question that removes a lot of shame is, are there subjects regarding our childhoods that we should agree right now to discuss with a professional rather than expecting each other to process them alone?
Just having that question on the table normalizes the fact that a spouse cannot be a therapist.
To synthesize everything we've explored today, the architecture of a marriage requires you to respect the family you came from, but fiercely protect the family you are building.
Use the practical tools. Map your rhino and hedgehog tendencies. Enforce the decision rule.
But handle deep childhood trauma with the clinical, specialized care it requires, understanding that a 5-minute visualization is not a substitute for untangling the fishing line. Building a unique marital culture is a lifelong curation project.
It is an ongoing process of negotiation. And as we close, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. One that reshapes how we view the invisible infrastructure we carry. We often think about our family of origin in terms of what we are forced to inherit. The burdens, the unresolved trauma, the unhelpful communication styles. But what if you viewed your family history as a giant thrift store?
A thrift store. I like where this is going.
You do not have to buy the whole inventory. You have the ultimate power to walk down the aisles, lovingly select the heirloom strengths that fit perfectly into your new home, and completely leave behind the toxic, damaged patterns that simply do not belong in your future.
You are the architect now. You get to choose what goes into the house. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us. We'll catch you next time.